Welcome to our podcast episode on immigration policy for a liberal world. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership, known by its German acronym IAF. Located in German town of Gummersbach, the Academy trains leaders working for partner organizations of Frederick Norman Foundation for Freedom all over the world. The Academy is renowned for bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and challenges, and more importantly, to develop liberal solutions to public policy challenges. In today's episode, we pick a rather complex topic of immigration. Immigration, both legal and illegal, has been a hotly debated topic around the world as more wars break out and societies have to deal with refugees from war-torn areas. In addition, people are looking for migration opportunities when they can't deal with either suppression or lack of economic opportunities or just a better life than the one they're living in the country in which they are born. Now, recipient countries, of course, face challenges such as additional pressures on social services, clashes of culture, and or a change in the value system. At the same time, they benefit out of the addition to the labor force and the contribution to the economy that the migrants bring in various forms. So what kind of principles underpin a workable immigration policy to address the challenges that the countries that are recipients and countries that send migrants can work with? Some of the most contentious issues that underpin the immigration debate we'd like to cover today include polarization versus social cohesion, the extent of government aid, and the age-old question of individual freedom versus the limits to individual freedom. In order to tackle this rather complex issue, we are joined by renowned experts who will share their insights on framing immigration policies that are practical and will be able to address challenges we face today. My name is Arpita Nepal, and I will be co-hosting this episode with my friend and colleague, Rainer Heufels.
Hello, Arpita. It's great to be here. I really look forward to this discussion. Let me also introduce our first speaker today, Senator Mohamed Magdi Farid from Egypt. Farid and I, we actually know each other from the International Academy for Leadership. He is an alumni of one of the seminars, and it was a great pleasure meeting him there, and we have had more occasions later to meet. He is actually a classical liberal politician and a senator in Egypt since 2020. He's there the deputy chairman of the Committee for Social Solidarity and Human Rights at the Senate of Egypt. But he also has a long political career. Farid is a founding member of the Free Egyptians Party, and he participated in the economic committee of the National Salvation Front, which was an alliance of political parties in Egypt. He is also an avid networker. So he's a member of the executive committee of the Arab Youth Alliance, a member of the executive office of the Egyptian and Danish parties network, and he helped to coordinate efforts of young parties and politicians. And finally, he is also a founding member of the Liberal Club in Cairo, which is a youth initiative for a better business environment in Egypt. Farid joins us today as a speaker because he has taken a key interest in immigration. It shows that he recently just published an article in the Daily News Egypt, which was titled Creating Prosperity and Enhancing Security for All, the Case of Egypt and Migrants. In that article, Farid argued that prosperity and improved security through proper migration policy must then include free market policies and support the most vulnerable population. It's great to have you with us, Farid. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's a great honor and a privilege to be here to see you again, Rainer. Thank you very much for that, for the opportunity. And it's always to participate in any activity with the Academy. It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And we also have with us today Professor Ken Schooland, who is a great friend of ours and has been for many, many decades supporting work of in general, classical liberals around the world. He's the Associate Professor of Economics and Director of Entrepreneurship Center at the Hawaii Pacific University in Honolulu. Ken served as an international economist in the U.S. International Trade Commission, the U.S. Department of Commerce, and on assignment to the Office of the Special Representative for Trade Negotiations. Ken is also a Sam Walton Fellow for Enactus, a member of the Montpelier Society, and on the board of scholars for the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii. He has authored two books, great books, The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible, A Free Market Odyssey, now published in 53 languages, which I'm happy to say Nepali is one of them, and Shogun's Ghost, The Dark Side of Japanese Education, which has been published in two languages. Ken is really passionate about the issue of immigration. He has published articles and delivered multiple lectures around the world on how migration has benefited and enriched societies. And he really praises the entrepreneurial spirit of the migrant population. Welcome, Ken, and thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to see you both. And to meet Farid, thank you very much for having me.
Great. So let me start off by delving a little bit on the history of immigration, specifically in your respective countries. Now, ideally, we would live in a world where, you know, movement of humans could not be curtailed. But the concept of nation states necessarily comes with borders, which means that defines our identity to a certain extent. Now, migration is as old as human civilization, and different countries have tackled the issue differently at different periods of time. So I'd like to begin, Ken, with you on if you could give us sort of a brief overview of migration history into the U.S., the benefits that you see that U.S. has reaped of out of migration as a result of this, and how has immigration policy changed, especially, let's say, in the last few decades? What kind of impact is it having in the society in U.S.? And are there specific challenges that you've identified with the increase of migration to the U.S.?
Okay, that's a major task there. And you're right, this is a great passion of mine. As you've noted, throughout history, people have always moved from one place to another because it's not always easy to change their climate or their government or their rulers. It's always easier to change their location and to find a place where they can live better and where they can avoid oppression and tyranny from wherever the cause has been. And that has been true for, since I'm talking about the United States, the first migrants came from probably Asia across the Bering Sea or from Polynesia to the Americans. That's the American Indians. And they were here in a multitude of tribes all throughout the Americas, North and South America. The next wave was from Europe, the European colonists, probably from the Vikings of north of Scandinavia first, but then the Spanish and the English and the Dutch and the French and all of the other colonial empires. When they came, their attitude towards people was very, very positive, as long as they were Europeans. It was a very, very positive attitude. They represented wealth and prosperity. That was the arms and legs to cultivate the soil and to create a new prosperity. And they were also leaving a very, very repressive world behind, a very, very, very impoverished world, very tyrannical world in Europe. And they found an extraordinary amount of freedom and opportunity coming to the Americas. Actually, one of the first articles in the Declaration of Independence, one of the reasons that the founding fathers of the United States wanted to have independence from England was because they wanted to allow more people to come. King George III wanted to control them, and they stated in the Declaration of Independence, no, we want more people, and the king has gotten in the way of them. And once the independence was obtained, then they had a completely open immigration policy for nearly 100 years, basically saying, come, you're welcome, you are valued. You know, it's sort of like today, people value barrels of oil, but don't value people. In those days, they knew nothing about oil, but they valued people. They had arms and legs and brains, and they were very industrious. In fact, the people who moved from the old world to the new world were the most industrious. It was a sort of selective process of the people with the greatest diligence and eagerness and hardworking, courageous people. And so it was a very selective process that brought a lot of prosperity. It was the period of unparalleled economic growth in the United States, between 1840 and 1940, there were 40 million people who came. And this is when the population was pretty small by comparison in those days. 40 million people coming across the Atlantic was a tremendous number. There were probably 4 million Irish who were fleeing the potato famine. Otherwise, they would have died. 5 million Germans were fleeing Bismarck's conscription and the imperial rule, and they may have died. Otherwise, 2 million Scandinavians came, and they were leaving a very, very impoverished country at that time, and many of them would have died. And 1 million Poles, and many others came. But over the years, the attitude towards migration was starting to be constrained by laws. For one, there were many black slaves in the southern United States, and they tried to flee as runaways to the north, but they had laws that prohibited them from escaping. They would be captured and returned to their slave owners. Now, we recognize today that this was an immoral law, and yet at the time it was what was considered to be illegal behavior for someone to steal themselves property that stole itself from its own rightful master. Years later, in the 1930s, there were millions of Jews and Poles and Central Europeans who wanted to flee the increasing repression of the Nazi regime and the fascist regime and the communist regimes in Europe at the time. And they were prohibited from leaving because of the new quota laws, the restrictions on immigration. And the restrictions in the United States first started as a racist measure against the Chinese. It was specifically called the Chinese Exclusion Act. But it was also a labor protection measure because the white European laborers didn't like the competition from people who were going to work harder at later hours, dirtier jobs, and for less pay than the white laborers. And they saw it as a way to get rid of their competition. And ever since then, not only have we had trade protections to prohibit people from buying products at lower prices from abroad, but we've had labor protection to prevent employers from hiring workers who were thought to be a competition. Now, I think the great thing about Julian Simon's work, he has compiled dozens of research reports of economists who look at the impact of newcomers in the market. And newcomers in the form of immigrants didn't lower wages of domestic workers, didn't reduce employment. They actually increased the opportunities for employment and prosperity. In fact, immigrants are twice as likely to be entrepreneurs themselves and starting businesses and producing wealth and prosperity. So in a way, that's a bit of a summary of the history in the United States. It got very, very restricted in 1924 with the restrictions, primarily to restrict anyone who wasn't from Northern Europe. They wanted to prevent the Catholics from coming. They wanted to prevent the Eastern Europeans from coming. And so it became a very ethnic and religious barrier to try and reduce the population. And I would say that it was a tremendous restraint on economic growth then as a consequence.
Great. Thank you very much. That's really, really fascinating history, you know, really bottled down U.S. history, because we always think of U.S. as a country of immigrants, a country built on immigration. So that was really, really fascinating look. Farid, let me come to you, because perhaps around the world, we know less about Egypt. Certainly for me, your article was highly educational because you gave a brief overview of how long Egypt has had a history of immigration. And so can you please briefly summarize and educate us a bit on Egyptian history and, you know, immigration patterns that you've observed or policies in recent years?
Thank you very much. You know, Egypt has long been a sanctuary for those fleeing persecution. A tradition dates back probably the biblical times. Many remember Egypt in the Bible before the Exodus, per se. But before that, the Israelites came to Egypt seeking refuge, you know, from a severe famine. And 2,000 years ago, the Holy Family sought safety here in Egypt from persecution. So it seems always we have a camp for welcoming those in need here in Egypt. Historically, Egypt has long been a refuge for those fleeing persecution. History spans from centuries. We welcomed Armenians, Greek, Jews, Palestinians, among others, who sought safety from conflict in their homelands. And our approach has always been one of integration, allowing these communities to contribute to enrich Egyptian society. by the end of 1914, for example, by the end of the Ottoman Empire defeat on the Russian front, many Jews moved from Palestine to Egypt, with their number reaching about 60,000 people by 1917. They mostly in Cairo and Alexandria. Those are the two largest cities in Egypt. But then the Egyptian government supported them, gave them the needed support, unofficially registered them. By the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 and the eruption of the Arab-Israeli conflict, about 750,000 Palestinians fled to neighboring countries, including Egypt, which provided the support and assistance and collaboration with the UNRWA. Actually, in 1949, Egypt established a special administration for the Palestinian refugees to oversee their affairs and provide necessary support for them. Also, Egypt played a significant role in defending the refugees' right in international forums, supporting UN General Assembly Resolution 194 in 1955, affirms the right for the Palestinian refugees to return their homes. Nonetheless, actually, Egypt was one of the very first countries to ratify a framework to support and to protect the refugees. Of course, now, in the recent years, in the 21st century, after the Iraq invasion 2003, the Arab and the eruption of Arab Spring, Egypt has seen significant refugee inflows from Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and most recently, of course, the Sudan after the civil war took place there. The key differences now is the sheer and scale and speed of this migration, the driven going national, regional instability. This presents both challenges and opportunities for Egypt. One hand, the rapid influx of refugees strained the security measures, particularly with the transnational issues of human trafficking and terrorism. Economically, the situation is further complicated because of the severe economic crisis Egypt had been through over the past few years after the COVID. However, in every challenge, there is an opportunity. The diverse skills and culture and cultural contributions of these refugees can enrich the societies and enhance the economy. If we focus on effective integration by minimizing bureaucratic barriers and encouraging their participation in the economy, lowering the barriers and allowing them the opportunity, we can transform these challenges into strength. So this is, in a nutshell, the situation in Egypt historically.
And thank you, Farid. Maybe I ask you a follow-up question here. Is Egypt representative for a country in the region in terms of immigration, or is it really an outlier? Is it so that, you know, Egypt takes in an extraordinary amount of immigrants, or would you say Egypt is a representative country in the Middle East, North Africa region?
Well, with regard to the influx of both migrants and refugees, there are estimates, according to the IOM, reaching about 9 million or almost 10 million migrant and refugee. And this is, to put it in context, Egyptian population is about 105 million persons. So you can imagine the amount of the refugees and migrants, and this is also one of the triggers for the rise of anti-migration sentiments, populations, xenophobia, and so on. So this is the case.
Thank you, Farid. And Ken, also a question to you. Maybe the U.S. is again a unique case. I'm wondering. When I look at what I read about migrants in the U.S. now, they have a higher employment rate than the rest of the population. But in Europe, I'm from Germany, so in Germany, on average, you have a 10% lower employment rate among migrants over there. And then England has come to fame recently for all the unrests. Over there, you see that Indian Pakistani communities have actually higher social mobility and upward mobility than the rest of the population. So I'm just wondering, given the long history of immigration in the United States that you summarized just now, do you think the U.S. is somehow better equipped to deal with migration, to integrate migrants, to let them thrive? Is that something unique about the United States?
Well, the thing that's unique about it is that there's less state intervention than there is in Europe. For example, the people, by far, most of them are moving to work, and they would like to work, but they're not allowed to by a lot of barriers. Number one, they're just not given work permission, or there stands in their way a lot of taxes and licenses and regulations that prevent them from getting into kinds of employment that they may be well-suited for and have done. So I would probably say the biggest difference between the United States and countries of Europe is that in the United States, though there are a lot of restraints on immigrants being allowed to work, it's still a lot easier to get around those restraints. And there's a lot less welfare offered to them, which I suppose is probably one of the biggest reasons for resentment among a local population. For example, in England just recently, the people who were protesting and rioting against the asylum seekers were looking at the fact that they weren't allowed to work. They're sitting in hotels that are paid for by taxes and very expensive operations. And, it wasn't a situation created by the refugees, but it was what the rioters saw, and they resented it. And so I think there was a lot more obstacle to people being able to assimilate into the society. And you look, for example, massive millions are leaving Venezuela recently. I was so impressed that Colombia was willing to accept so many millions of the refugees, as the Venezuelans had accepted of Colombians when they had their wars in a couple decades ago. And now also probably a million of them Venezuelans have come to the United States. And if I travel around the country, I find they're as waiters and taxi drivers and Uber drivers, and they're doing a lot of things in the gig market that is outside of usual constraints. So I don't know exactly how bad the situation is for newcomers in Europe, but I'm guessing that it is much more of a socialist obstacle, socialist state restraints on access to being able to earn a living, and then the motive to try and assimilate and to learn the language and to learn the culture.
Right. You're already addressing the issue with social cohesion, and obviously we have outbursts against immigration all over the world. I mean, this is really something we have to deal with, we have to grapple with. So again, coming back to Germany, my personal experience, we see first-generation migrants quite often making more of an effort to integrate into the host society. But then the following generations, they grapple more with their identity in the society where they were born into it, but they're not really feeling part of it. So they feel the difference much more. So we see the subsequent generations really struggle more to identify. So it's an issue of identity here. And now the whole war in Gaza situation has aggravated that a lot. We have seen now recent studies that showed that maybe half of British Muslims really support Hamas, at least in answering a questionnaire. We have a quarter of them basically saying the 7th of October atrocities never happened. So this is an indicator that they are struggling with where to identify with. And at the same time, over the last election cycles in Europe, in the UK, but also in the US, we see the rise of these either far-right movements or anti-immigration sentiments and movements. So this is happening all at the same time. We see Western societies more fragmented. People talk about the erosion of their values, liberal values. So it seems to be all about identity. Identity seems to be overarching and more important even than maybe merit-based progression markers. So I want to really grow in society. I want to earn a living, etc. So it's about loss of identity. It's about loss of values that becomes a narrative of we are the oppressed versus the oppressor in many situations. So Ken, you studied this. Let me just add another point. So it's you know you have studied this in very much, and we see the polarization at the moment really, really playing out in the United States. It's obviously a huge issue that the whole world is watching. Is it a result of migration, or rather, where does migration come into this picture? Does, you know, and I take it a step further, this individual freedom of movement, does it undermine social cohesion? Is that something we should be worried about, especially as liberals?
I think that the primary devil here is the politics of fear. Political leaders find that there's something they can play into, a kind of anxiety or fear that people can play into if they choose to. But one thing I really liked about what Friedrich said is that we could turn things into a positive. We just experienced the Olympics in Paris, and everyone was cheering the best of talent, whoever was the best. It didn't matter where they were from. It didn't matter what color their skin was or what their religion was. The best was championed. And that was such a great thing to people saying, yeah, wow, we should do that in sports. And 26% of the football players in Europe, I understand, are expats from other countries. In the United States, some of the best players, the most valuable players on the basketball teams and basketball leagues are foreigners. And yet, so there, the populace has turned into champions of the best and the brightest. Well, I think what we can do, what we should do, is try and turn this politics of fear into a positive. Why not allow every butcher, brewer, and baker to be able to also hire the best and the brightest? Why don't we turn this into a competition of great excellence excelling rather than always there, that person is a threat to me. And notice that when the Ukrainians fled, they were welcomed all around the world. I mean, all Europe and the United States welcomed them for the most part, even with open arms. And how could we help? As opposed to people from the Middle East. And so I think it's the population is vulnerable or is open to leadership in how you view the immigration. Is it a threat or is it an opportunity? And that's the difference between the market and the government. The government always views people as a threat or as a burden. But the marketplace always views people as an opportunity. Well, how can we get more jobs, more employment, more entrepreneurs? Whereas the government says, oh, it's a tax burden, it's a health burden, it's an education burden. People are a burden. And you look at every country is seeking barrels of oil more than people. Well, people should be considered much more valuable than barrels of oil, and yet they see people as a problem.
Ken, let me push back a little, but by asking Farid a question here. We see a lot of populist resistance and reactions. So these are people, and if you want the market, that would be very much anti-immigration. So it's populists, and also in Egypt, you're struggling with this. You mentioned already that in Sudan, you had this terrible civil war, and it's your neighbor to the south. So a lot of them had to flee for their life, as Ken was saying. You know, they tried to just basically survive and come to Egypt. Now you have the populist resistance to this. And so my question to you would be, is this resistance based on values that they bring with them from Sudan? Or is it about the economic hardship that they might bring for ordinary Egyptians? So are people fearing for their job, or are people fearing for their values? And this is not just from Sudan. You obviously also have a huge influx of refugees from Palestine and other areas. How does it work in Egypt?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a mixture of many things, but it's not about the values. The values now start to pop up, you know, on the surface. It's different habits, it's different way of life, it's different stuff. But deeply embedded, it's more about the false pretenses of economic opportunity. Migrants, it's you find it everywhere, actually, and it's astonishing me because we are not unique, but we have different contexts, you know, from Europe, for example, or from the United States. But you find this, yeah, migrants are stealing our jobs. Migrants are taking the opportunity of our children in the schools. They flood the healthcare system. They raise the rent and so on and so forth. But this is, I don't like to use harsh words, but allow me, it's ridiculous. Okay. Why? Because simply, if you look at the unemployment rates in Egypt, you know, given that Egypt has a very high informal market, but according to the formal statistics, unemployment rates is not increasing. On the contrary, it's decreasing. So this gives you something. When you look at something with related to the battle, one of the plights, one of the tragedies that the Sudanese people have here, that they are fleeing the southern world, they are fleeing for their lives. So they have to be, you know, like living 2, 3, 4 families in one small apartment. And you can imagine this, they didn't choose that. If they choose, they would choose definitely to live in a better condition. But this is, of course, due to the plight that they are having. And many people find this, yeah, they are overwhelming the place. They are they have different style of life and so on and so forth. So this is baseless facts. You know, it's based on pure populism. But there are also one other element that is a real threat. It's about the radicalization. With all the instability going in the region, with all the civil wars happening, actually, also trying to be very subjective here, the every border of Egypt is now expected to be a front. We have a civil war in the south, instability in the east in Libya. In the West in Libya. Of course, the war in Gaza in the East, in the Red Sea, there are the Houthi attacks. I couldn't recall such amount of challenges that have been there over probably centuries. Among all that, there is embedded the radicalization and the radical Islam. We saw how it leads to waves of terrorism and creating disasters. However, it's crucial to understand that immigration and radicalization are not inherently linked. Many migrants and refugees are fleeing areas torn by radicalization, seeking safety and better future. Yet, there are cases where radical and criminal elements exploit migration flows to spread their malevolent acts, posing challenges to both innocent migrants and the hosting communities. So this is. A credible threat that we need to take care about, and we need to enhance law and order to be able to protect those people who are fleeing tragedies of war, you know, and or even those who are seeking a better life, you know, in other countries from the malevolent impact of whether radical terrorists, radical Islamists, or other criminal elements. So in a nutshell, it's more about the claims of lack of economic opportunity, and this is due to the government intervention. I fully agree with Ken, by the way, in what he said, that it's a problem of government intervention. It's lack of market freedom. It's about how the government looks at it. You know, it's this socialist mindset that the government should provide everything, but if we open the market, you will find that the refugees are doing and the migrants are doing a fantastic job, you know, trying to create a good life for themselves and their families.
Right, that's a very interesting point. And just to create this sort of discussion around this, what we see in popular media, the populist debate, is very much around us versus them narratives, right? So in the Western media, this very much, you know, oh, this is certain culture or religion that is overtaking our culture, our religion. They don't even speak the language in the country that they are coming into. All of these are pointed out as problems and saying there's a different value system that's been created. You know, this is what you hear very often on people who protest against immigration, like open immigration policies. But like from your experience in Egypt, you're getting a lot of migrants from the same, you know, with the same culture, the same religion. So how is this debate framed in Egypt? I'm just out of curiosity, like what is the us versus them marker there then?
Okay, when it comes to bigotry, when it comes to populism, us versus them could be those who wear plain T-shirts and those who wear printed T-shirts. It's as simple as that and as pathetic as that. I'm sorry for using that kind of language, but it is. Yes, it's true that we received migrants and refugees from other Arab countries who share the same language, who share the same Sunni Islam per se, and this is very specific. The school of thought of Islam, but here you got, they have different habits. They have different style. They caused civil war in their countries and they caused instabilities in their countries, and now they are spreading it here. You know, they are lazy and they didn't get high marks in their home countries, and now they are coming here to join our colleges and pay less or free, you know, because this is one of the privileges Egypt offering the refugees and migrants, especially from the Arab countries. They can go there with lower grades than the native Egyptians, and they are getting more opportunities than ours. So it's not deeply rooted in the value. It's just claims, not that true. But also trying to be as objective as I can get, you know. One of the real concerns are, as I mentioned before, radicalization, because there are some radical elements came here trying to spread this radicalization, and this is something really dangerous. Other than that, some security concerns, because some migrants and refugees turn to create small gangs, you know, and especially in the poorer areas, in the slums areas and unplanned areas, they form gangs, you know, and they start to have these clashes. And again, this could be put in the context of the incitement of hatred from one side and a response for it. I'm trying to be, as telling you, that objective. Yes, there are some horrific crimes taking place, but again, these are criminals, and in every society there are criminals, whether in the local societies, whether in the foreigners, whether in their home countries, whether here, it's everywhere. And this is why it's important to have these strong security measures and law and order and rule of law that everybody's subjected to, and not to generalize something.
Great. Thank you very much. I think that's a very eloquent response to this us versus them narrative.
Ken, the question is, you know, we're talking about social cohesion here, actually, right? Would you be worried that social cohesion can, I mean, or perceived threats to social cohesion, can they lead to nationalist movements? Do you think there is a relationship between threats to social cohesion and a nationalism that's emerging again?
Well, yes, I think we come back to this point of the politics of fear. It is a very powerful tool that in this country, the Trump administration and the Biden administration are both eager to play into this idea that The world is against us, and we are we must pull together and fight off the world in order to remain strong and therefore solve that problem by electing me. And of course, our response can't be to fall victim to the fear, because if the fear always leads to increased government control and power. And we recognize that whenever the government does that, there are unintended consequences that leave us worse off. I mean, the first of the big immigration barriers, it used to be that 97% of immigrants who applied for immigration got in. And there were a few people who were selected out, not allowed to come in for a variety of reasons. Interestingly enough, one of the obstacles to coming in was that they were a rebel against the government in their home country. So therefore, all the American founding fathers would not have qualified to come in under those conditions, because they were all rebels. They were all faced the hanging of King George III if they had been caught. But at any rate, but then after these laws of prohibition came about in the 1920s, then only 3% of the people were allowed in. And that's when illegal immigration became pronounced, because it went to all to the black market. At the same time, that's when they passed prohibition against alcohol. And that's when the black market grew enormously with, bootleg alcohol and all of that. And they recognized that it was a horrific consequence. So therefore, they got rid of prohibition because they realized it fueled the black market. But they didn't get rid of the prohibition on migration. And so therefore, ever since, we've had a black market in the travel agencies. Now, I know this is called human trafficking when it's illegal, but I mean, I go to a travel agent and I say, well, help me get a visa or an airplane ticket. And it costs me a couple hundred dollars or so to do so. But someone who can't get the legal barriers, they have to go to the illegal market. And of course, as we all know, anything in the illegal market is going to be perverse and corrupt and fuel lots of money to corrupt elements. The desperate people who are looking for that thing. If we really want to end the black market in trafficking, then we want to open up the gate, have a very big gate that's very efficient and competent. Now, if you think about how it is that's different between the government in charge of processing, and if it was a private company, processing customers. They're also concerned about security and health of their customers, but they process them in minutes or days. But the government, they take years. I mean, to get a visa to come into the United States now can take, it can take anywhere from 3 to 100 years. People often die before they are actually qualified to get their visas. And the processing is extremely slow. So instead of spending billions of dollars on a wall or increased technology, they could just process people more rapidly and end this this big backlog at the border. And I think that to pick up on Farid's comment earlier, too, about making this a positive, if we can show the positive effects that yes, there was a terrorist who came across the border, but your chances of dying from a terrorist are like 1 out of 4 million, as the Cato Institute calculates. We know that we don't hold people collectively responsible. We hold them individually responsible. There was a terrorist named Timothy McVeigh who bombed a building in Oklahoma, created the biggest death count in American terrorist activity. He came from New York, but it wouldn't make sense for us to outlaw everybody from New York because of the action of one terrorist. Likewise, we don't say that because the government is a cost to welfare, we don't say that women are not allowed to have children because their children may be born into a society that's going to cost education and healthcare and 20 years of learning and training before they are able to take care of themselves. We don't say that one form of freedom is contingent on another form of freedom. So I'm sorry to flood out all this fury, but I'm excited about this topic. I'm passionate about it because because so many people are dying at the border, trying to get a couple thousand on the Mediterranean Sea, a thousand at the deserts of Arizona. There are people dying, and they are so desperate for these for improvement and conditions. So I think we ought to see the positive things that they bring to the world by moving from a place of tyranny to a place of freedom. That's our great thing, to display the virtues of a free society and why people move. They vote with their feet all around the planet from places of relative tyranny to places of relative freedom. And that's the greatest signal that we can possibly show of what the value of our classical liberal society is.
That's a very fascinating point, Ken, because I just watched a documentary last night on immigrants who are now trying to hire another boat back from Dover to Calais because the opportunities in England are so limited for them. So I saw a reverse migration documentary, which is very fascinating because in this debate, I think we lose a lot of nuances. But I want to pick up on your point about one freedom not being contingent on another. Whenever, as classical liberals in general, we say, let people come, stand on their own merit, so on and so forth, right? But especially if you come from war-torn areas, and especially as a refugee status, to what extent do you think we should be aiding or providing collective help in the form of government aid for this immigration process specifically? Or should this be completely left up to whoever can vote with their feet, whoever has the ability to leave their country and vote with their feet? So what sort of intervention, if you think any, is required at all in this field?
The problem with asking the government to do it with tax funds, because that's their source, is that then you're asking for resistance from the taxpayer. It says, well, that's not none of my business, or I'm against that. And so that's the negative of having the government intervene. But there are plenty of volunteer organizations, churches and philanthropies and all kinds of volunteer groups who would help if they were allowed to. Actually, the biggest helper would be an employer. There are companies all across the country that if they can't hire cheap labor from somebody coming across the border, they have to move their company abroad to find the cheap labor abroad. So the best help right there would be, and this is the way labor used to come to Hawaii, for example. The contractors used to go to China and Japan and Portugal to hire laborers to come to work the plantations in Hawaii. And they made all their employment contracts even before they left those countries. They had it all lined up. But all that was made illegal. It was illegal for a contractor to go abroad and make this contract. Just simply legalize that now, and you'll have companies like Amazon and Boeing and Silicon Valley going over to those places, to the refugee centers or wherever, and saying, here's a contract. We'll sponsor you. So you don't even have to pay your passageway, which is also illegal, actually, now.
That's a fascinating point. Like you said, like when we dedicate taxpayers' money, that's one of the key areas which breeds resentment in general. So it's a very important point. Farid, let me come to you, because in your article, what I found very fascinating is you've talked about 60% of the migrants who have been living in Egypt who show a very high level of integration. And you credit that to, the government assistance that Egypt has provided. Can you sort of elaborate a little bit on what kind of inclusive policies are we talking about here?
Well, I need just to get back a little bit to Ken's argument, which is fantastic and brilliant one. And I'd like to highlight something. You know, most of the refugees, most of the migrants are coming from places where there is a lack of freedom, lack of opportunity, and severe government intervention. So let me hear wear the other hat. If I'm someone who is against migration and I don't like to see the others coming to my place, the best policy for that is to spread freedom and spread opportunity and to work on that, to create opportunity and freedom in other countries and globally. because this where you will find the opportunity. Those people who are seeking better opportunity and better lives will go there. And this is actually what you've been mentioning about this documentary. You was talking about people are looking for opportunity, and yes, among them there might be some terrorists, among them there might be some criminals, but still, by the end of the day, the main factor here is opportunity and freedom. So let's never forget this, and let's see how can we improve and enhance it locally and globally. Having said that, when it comes to Egypt, one of the policies Egypt is doing that we don't do refugee camps. We don't have any refugee camps in Egypt. You know, we have this open camp policy. Refugees, migrants come over. They're just integrated in the society. And as much as this is a good thing, sometimes it created clashes. You know, of course, when the times are bad and there is this high wave of populism taking place, but still, the benefits outweighs the negatives in this. The majority of refugees and migrants are located in the urban areas, the big cities in Egypt. Adding to that, the schools are open for refugees and migrants as equal as the Egyptians, and this is something really important because, again, if we're talking about the liberty, the opportunity, it's important to allow these people to interact freely with each other, to enhance and enrich the diversity and improve the culture, you know. So instead of being isolated in your own bubble, opening up to the society, sharing the values, and it's important actually back again to a point Rainer make it earlier. It's about the second generation, you know, and third generation. This is where you find the children of the migrants and refugees interact and deal with their peers, you know, and start to understand the sense of community here, you know, and this is where you create this melting pot per se, you know, and this is where you get the opportunities and the benefits of the migration, because you add small piece toward this beautiful mosaic by the end of the day, and it enriches it. So offering education is important. Opening up the cities for the people and don't have a refugee camp. This is an important. And again, let me use the other hat here, you know, and trying to look at it from the other side. If you are afraid of the other, and if you find the other have different set of values, if you have the stronger values, if you have the more accommodating and welcoming values, you have nothing to fear about, because they will be integrated, you know. They will come in, you know, and have it. Actually, this is the experience with Egypt, you know. If you look at historically, as I mentioned, you know, many waves of refugees have been coming to Egypt all over through the history, and you have this unique per se Egyptian mosaic, you know, where you have all these elements came together and created the modern society that we are living here today. You have this sense of Mediterranean and the Arab part, the African part, all this all together mixed together, creating what we are here now. And actually, this is why people come to Egypt, you know, because we do have, you know, this sense of opportunity. We have this sense of openness, and we do have this sense of inclusion, and this creates a better life for everyone.
Thank you, Farid. This is a very interesting debate, and I want to take it to the policy level again. You know, sure. I hear you saying we should not limit people's freedom by putting them into camps or putting them into forced housing, so to speak, which is happening in different ways and shapes all over the world, obviously. But it has to continue. So this is just the beginning, right? So this is after they've crossed the border. And now the question is, how will this melting pot really appear? How does that work? And what the experience is in Europe, that it's less a melting pot. So we see children with a migration background, but in the third generation, maybe, boys refusing to listen to female teachers because they say, I'm not in my culture. And I mean, this boy is born in Germany and never went to anywhere close to Syria, Libya, wherever the family is coming from, to say, we are not taking orders for women. This is not going to happen. So this is a real challenge that many schools are really dealing with. So it's less and less an integration. In Europe, or at least in Germany, the idea of multiculturalism is largely discredited. The French have refused to publish statistics for a long time, saying we're égalité, so we're all the same. We don't even publish statistics. And in Germany, there's a big discussion whether you should actually publish the nationality of a criminal when it gets into the newspapers and police statements or not. It's going back and forth. At one point, they say we cannot. Now they say we should. So this is really a struggle. And so the question is, where do we limit freedom in a way, for example, that we require people to learn the local language, that they have to learn about the culture and the values of the host society? Are there limits? I mean, I'm moving away from now employment, a right of getting employed, etc. This is really more on the cultural side. To what extent can we act on that? And that would include naturalization, for example, how easy should we make it? Not that it seems to have a proven empirical effect on the integration, but it at least might be a tool to give somebody the feeling that person is accepted and respected in the community. Ken, maybe to you first. So if you look at that and a rational, is it an immigration policy or an integration policy that's left to be debated? But what do you think about this?
Yeah, actually, I see this, again, as a problem of the state construct. For example, the kid who says, well, I'm in a government school and I don't have to pay attention to a government teacher because, well, I'm required to be here. I'm required, you know, everybody is required to pay for it and I can do as I please. So of course, in government schools, you're going to have so much more clash of values because you've got a state stool that's trying to impose a particular value. That's why I love the diversity of private schools because, first of all, if you're in a private school and you don't pay attention to the teacher or you don't respect the teacher, you're out. You're kicked out and no one has to pay for it. And then that student then has to say, well, I either straighten up and get, you know, smart in this class or I have to find another school that will take me. But the government school doesn't allow that freedom of choice for the teacher and for the student and for the person paying for it. So that's one thought that comes to mind about that. I loved Farid's point about competition of values. That I mean, the best of values are going to be appreciated. That's what all competition brings about, an appreciation of variety. I live in Hawaii, where we have the most diverse ethnic background of all, and people like coming to Hawaii because of this tremendous diversity. It's an enriching thing that is much appreciated. But what about criminal action? Well, or some of the other points that were being made. Oh, one thing that strikes me is the European Union had one of the greatest experiments when they expanded the European Union from 6 countries to 27 countries with free movement around the European Union. Now, I don't recall that they required everybody to learn the language or to learn the particular customs when they were admitted into the European Union. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that because I'm not as familiar with Europe as you are. But it was a great demonstration of the value of opening up. I mean, they, as I understand, in those days, they were talking about trying to become a United States of Europe. We've got 50 states. Everybody can move freely from one state to another. And they walk with their feet from the high tax states like California and New Mexico and New York to the low tax states of Texas and Florida, choosing by just moving their best value. And then that serves as a laboratory where the different areas then see what works and what doesn't work. And they have to change their policies if they want to attract people back. So this kind of competition is always a valuable type of thing in a free society. And the larger your reach is for that, the greater your chance is for competition. And now I don't want to get into the whole debate about EU versus independence, but that I thought was a remarkable thing to allow people to move. Because as I understand it, there were people in the European Union that when Spain was adapted, they left European Union because they were informal workers in France and Germany who went home because now they could go back and forth freely. And there were a lot of people who moved from Eastern Europe into countries to job in Western Europe, but the investment poured into those other countries that changed their policies in Eastern Europe. So there was a real dynamic that was positive and growth. Now, if I think that if you want to find positive examples of how this stuff of migration can work, I'd say you've got a great example, right, with the European Union and within itself. China actually shows, by the great migration of China, the movement of people, 240 million people moved from Western provinces to Eastern provinces. It led to probably 20 to 30% of their growth over the 20-year period of time because of just allowing people to move from relatively unfree regions to relatively free regions. So there, I think we can find lots and lots of examples about how people find the melting pot, the integration. Now, it isn't perfect. There's always going to be examples that people can point to, but we've got to point out to them in response, those are exceptions when things didn't work out, you know, when there's the crime. Because statistically speaking, the Cato Institute has done a number of studies showing the crime rate of immigrants and illegal immigrants is lower than that of the native population. I mean, frankly, if they started deporting Native American criminals, that would probably serve as a good lesson in the positive effects of this sort of thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. And Farid, you know, this does not happen in a vacuum, obviously. I mean, all the benefits that we hear about and that we see are not happening in a vacuum. So we do have this populist backlash. We have this abuse of the issue by certain forces in society for their ends. We can see that very clearly all over the world, really. If in your position, you want to give an advice to Egyptian policymakers, no? I mean, given that kind of like background that, you know, there's a lot of resistance now, or at least there's a growing resistance and so on, what would your advice to policymakers be in this situation, given the same question about learning the language, culture, values, and all of that?
Yeah, that's brilliant. I'd like just to highlight a few things. First of all, you know, what's really beautiful about the classical liberals, what's about the values of freedom in general, that it is imperfect by nature. And this is the main driver for improvement. Because if it's perfect and we say that we live in a utopia, we'll end up by a horrible thing like communist China or the Soviet Union or any other horrible place like that. But this is how we evolve, you know, this is how things are moving for. So this is something we have to put it in our mind as classical liberals, as politicians, as experts, as academics. There is amount of imperfectionism, and this is something beautiful, and we have to embrace it. So this is first. Second, when it comes to the integration and the melting pot and so on, again, one of the main cuts that we do have, and we experience it here in Egypt and in the Middle East in general, and now it's been exported to Europe, is the radicalization and the radical Islam. And this is a main threat, you know. And this puts a barrier, you know. And the problem with that it's not just isolationist approach. It's isolationist, you know, but also would like to impose and coerce people to their set of values. It's not about accepting the other and coexistence. And this is the main problem, you know, and this is where you need to do something, you know, because there is this lack of tolerance, you know. And this is where there is the thin line between the problem with the private schools. I personally am pro privatization of everything possible we can do, but with such set of values and with such set of mindset, you will end up by creating these small bubbles of intolerance, of extremism, of hatred toward the others. And this is a real challenge, you know, and I don't have a simple answer to that, but it is a challenge. Back again to the case of Egypt and what kind of policies. And I don't feel very comfortable saying that because as a classical liberal, as someone who looks for the future, I don't like to fall in the trap of the nostalgia. But we have to set up experiences. An experience of Egypt receiving migrants and refugees in the first half of the 20th century and late 19th century. This where we have a limited government, very low market barriers, and open market. This is where the integration happened. This is where you receive people even who doesn't speak the same language. And you start to see these cosmopolitan cities in like Alexandria and some parts of Cairo. Of course, it wasn't an easy ride. It wasn't rosy. There were clashes. There were populism. There were ultranationalism. Given that by this time, there was the rise of communism, the rise of ultranationalism, the clashes between foreigners and locals, it happened. But still, by the end of the day, the end result was beautiful. In addition to the society, there was a great benefit for everyone. There was this openness toward the world, and there was this advancement of the society. Now, the second half, when Egypt turned towards socialism and large government intervention, yet with its commitment toward the refugees and supporting the migrants. This didn't change probably since the dawn of history in Egypt. What's happened? You find the populism, you find the isolationism, you start to find the radicalization more and more and less integration. Why? Because of the welfare state and the lack of competitiveness. Yet, the silver lining in that Egypt has a large informal economy. And we all know the negative and downsides of informality. We all know that, but there is also small silver lining there that the informality means almost no barriers for entering and getting out of the market. So this created opportunity for a lot of the migrants and refugees. And you can see this in the small and medium size and even micro enterprises, and you can see these people how entrepreneurial they are and how they take the initiative. And I'll give you a fine example for that. And with the Syrian migration wave, the Syrians start to open a lot of small restaurants for the Syrian cuisine, and now there is this huge chain of Syrian restaurants here in Egypt. And the I found out that the owner is Egyptian. Now, it started as Syrian cuisine and small Syrian restaurants and cafes, but now because it became popular and there is a demand and people like it, Egyptians started open this chain of restaurants serving Syrian cuisine with Syrian name and some Syrian migrants working there, but the owners are Egyptians. So this is the case, you know, that the beauty of the markets, that when you open up for competition, when you open up the markets, when you let the people work, they will have the initiative, they will do well, they will try to make the best of the available, and you will have this great notion of creativity taking place. Of course, again, it's imperfect. A lot of bad things would happen, a lot of negativities happen, but still, the benefits outweigh the negativity, and you end up by a society better off, and everybody is better off due to this individual and free interaction between people and the free enterprise and taking the initiative. So simply, less welfare state, more free market, lower the barriers. By doing that, you shouldn't forget about law and order and restricting the security, but don't suffocate the people. Rule of law is essential, and in case of we don't have rule of law, we will end to have this lawlessness, and no one would benefit from it. So law and order is important. Strict, and by strict I don't mean in a negative way, but strict by meaning enforced migration policies and creating opportunities. Let's never forget that any migrant, any refugee, our people are, as Ken beautifully said it, they are voting by their feet. These people are moving toward better opportunity. And this is simply the history of mankind, that this migration waves all through the history was from people going from a place to another place for better opportunity and more freedom.
Thank you, both of you. Sometimes speaking to classical liberals really feels like I've come back to my echo chamber, but also it provides me a relief from the craziness in terms of discussions we have, where, you know, most of the discussions around these issues become polemic. It becomes about, you know, a lot about us versus them debate to a large extent. So I think this was a very interesting take on migration, but also to look at migration, not as both of you pointed out, not as a problem, but as a possible opportunity, but also look at the resentment as a whole set of policies that breeds resentment, not necessarily if immigration is seen as the first symptom of that breeding resentment against the governance that you're facing in your respective country. So Ken and Fareed, thank you so much for your time. Absolutely fabulous talking to both of you.
Thank you very much, Arpita and Rainer. It's so great. Actually, when I heard that Fareed was going to be on here and he was a classical liberal, I breathed a great sigh of relief, because this wasn't going to be a battle of blood and guts. It was going to be a good, friendly interaction. I'm so pleased to meet you, Fareed, and so glad to see my old friends, and I hope to see you all again. Actually, come to visit me in Hawaii. I'm sure that the government will give you all visas to come and visit me. I've even got a room here, and I'll sponsor you if they require anything at all.
Thank you, Ken, for your generous heart and offer.
Well, Arpita, Rainer, thank you very much. It's been great to see you and to have this fantastic conversation. Ken, it's a great honor, a great privilege to talk to you. I learned a lot, and this conversation, actually, guys, it's very quite a relief, quite bringing me to sanity again, because with the notion of craziness and madness all over the place and feel that you are just debating the fundamentals, it's crazy, it's exhausting and hectic. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you very much for this time, and I'd love to see you all in Cairo someday soon.
Thank you
also from my side. As Ken said earlier, this is about saving lives, so this is really a serious matter. But that doesn't mean we can have a lighthearted and yet informed discussion about it. Also, thank you from my side.
Okay. Aloha.
Yeah. Aloha. Hi.
We just heard from two experts on the larger benefits of migration and how it really needs to be viewed in a positive light while being diligent about potential challenges that and that none of the solutions we provide will actually be perfect. But a discussion about immigration would be really incomplete if we did not also include a story of a migrant who has successfully integrated and contributes positively to the society. We're very, very grateful to be joined today by Mr. Akash Puratoki, who is a Bhutanese refugee who managed to migrate to Sweden and is successful integrated there. Akash is an active social worker and a politician with an immigrant background. Born in Bhutan, he was forced to flee the country as a child, spending his early years in India and later in Nepal. He completed his high school and university studies in India. Around 19 years ago, he was resettled in Sweden by the UNHCR. In Sweden, he learned Swedish and pursued further studies at the university level. During this time, he became involved with the Red Cross, where he was elected to the board and later worked as an integration coordinator for more than a decade. He's managed several projects and had the opportunity to observe changes in immigration patterns and attitudes towards asylum seekers over time. His commitment to Red Cross continues, and a few days ago, he was elected as the chair of the local branch. In addition to this role, he was also elected as a member of the municipal council, the regional council, and a chair of the Children's and Education Committee in his home municipality. In 2022, he was elected as a deputy member of parliament. He hasn't been able to serve in that role as yet. He hasn't had the opportunity. Academically, he holds a degree in political science from India and in sociology from Swedish University. He's currently in the final stages of completing his master's degree in sociology. Very much welcome to the podcast, Akash.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the introduction.
So, Akash, yeah, indeed, Arpita has given us a great introduction to you, but it would be fantastic to hear a bit more from yourself, you know, to get a deeper understanding of your story, which came through in so many data that we just heard from Arpita. And I'm asking this because Ken and Fari, they just gave us, in a way, the vision of an open society, open to immigration, etc. But it was really a big picture view. Now, you have gone through the reality of migration. You have done it yourself. So would love to hear from you. Why did you do all of that? Why the immigration? And how has that shaped you actually in who you are today? Can you share a bit more about that?
Thank you so much. Yeah. And thank you for the introduction. Like, I come from a very poverty family. My father stood against the Bhutanese government discriminated law, which deprived the majority of the southern Bhutanese, particularly those of Nepalese origin, who lived in Nepal, who left Nepal and lived in Bhutan for generations of the basic rights. Nepali people, who are mostly Hindus, faced several restrictions, including being prohibited from celebrating in the festivals, practicing the customs and traditions. The government mandated the national dress in public places, and then schools and offices removed the Nepali language from the school curriculum. And those who protested against were tortured, jailed, and women and children were abused by the Royal Bhutanese Army. So my father stood against this. He spoke against this brutal act, which led the army to target him. As a result, he was one of the first person to flee the country. He could not stay back in the country, so he came to India. Soon around more than 100,000, especially the Bhutanese-speaking people from the southern Bhutanese, Bhutan, they joined him. He then founded the first political party and led the Bhutanese democratic movement. Soon after, I must be around something like 7 to 8 years old. Some of our family friends, they helped us, my mother and two of my younger brothers, four of us to join my father in India. First we came to India and then later to Nepal. In Nepal, we lived in a refugee camp for some time and then moved on to other places. Unfortunately, I lost my father in 2001. He was murdered, and about 40 days later, my younger brother disappeared. We still have no idea about his whereabouts. We still have no knowledge about his whereabouts. Everything was so confusing and filled with uncertainty, and numerous rumors were going on and threats were filled, and it was really difficult to understand what's going on around. So with the support of UNHCR, some years later, I was given the opportunity to get resettled, and I got resettled in Sweden. Already then, like, I was politically active. I participated in different conferences where I said our stories are advocated for our cause. So this is the background that I have to tell about my being a small young boy in Bhutan and ending up being a refugee in Sweden.
It's very good that you shared it with us, Akash, because, of course, many people wouldn't know these kind of things about the country of Bhutan. So it's important, and thank you for sharing this. And this must also be difficult for you to share, I believe. But can I also say now, how has that shaped you into who you are today? You know, how much does that determine who you are, where you live now? Is this shaping your existence in Sweden?
You know, like, whatever we do in our life, it teaches us a lesson. It gives some kind of reference. It gives some kind of understanding to how we deal about this. What I have learned is, like, I was a refugee long before I even understood the word refugee. I was 7, 8 years old. One fine day, when I came back from the schools, happy boy, running around, like, joined my mother, and then, like, it was middle of the night, we were forced to leave the country and came to India first, and then, like, we started it. We walked out together to, you know, like, restart the life once again. It was tough. We did not have the economic resources. In India, as a refugee, like, we did not have any kind of support. We did not have some kind of families. They did not have the employment. Everything we had, like, we had to live and run away. So we didn't have anything to start with. It's made, like, life really difficult. One thing which I think a lot today, long after, is that, like, we have to take democracy in a serious manner. You know, like, when I was like about 25, 26 years of years, for the first time, I could say that, like, I have a country I live in, a country that can be mine. I was then not even the citizen in Sweden. I was still a refugee living in Sweden. But the way Sweden, then, you know, like, behaved me, the support they provided, the facilities they gave, and also opened up the society to be the part in this political process, in the democratic process, to be the member in the political party, all that, you know, like, was something I could just dream about just different for a few years. So, like, what I have understood is, like, what I take with me is, like, democracy has to be taken with seriousness. It's nothing. It comes free. It needs to be, you know, like, taken care of. And it's very important that each and everyone who has this opportunity takes part in a proper way and take care of the democracy so that democracy exists.
That's super beautiful, Akash. Like, I have almost goosebumps when he said that, because I think often when we live in comfortable places where our identity is not threatened, when you have the ownership of the country, we take a lot of things for granted, including democracy. And so this, you know, we need to be vigilant about it. We might lose it to any kind of autocratic regime any day, is an incredibly important message. I just want to come and ask you, probably this is a difficult question again, but how do you see yourself in terms of being integrated? Like, I can already feel your love for the country that you've adopted, because it has given you so much. Is, you know, I can see the, you know, sort of hear the gratefulness in what you're describing. But, like, in terms of integration within the Swedish society, like, you know, I just want to understand, A, what are some of the challenges you faced? And B, like, how did you overcome these kind of challenges in terms of, you know, integrating in a very, very different society than the one that you've come from?
You know, like, today I feel like I feel that I am a Swedish. What does that mean? Like, I cannot explain it, but I feel like I belong to this society. I have the right to belong to the society, and I have the opportunity to belong to the society. So I feel at home in Sweden. But in Sweden, we have something called Jantelagen, the concept that values modesty and discourages the standing out stuff. We also embrace the idea of logum, which means like finding the perfect balance, not too much, not too little. So while I might not have the answer to your question, the fact that I don't could actually be a sign that I am quite Swedish at heart already. You know, like it's really interesting and very important question, I think. In Swedish context, like there is a system where there are like political ideas and plans and you know, like the government policies, how immigration has to go on, how you take care of the people, those who come to this country. Besides providing this, let's see, the Swedish schools where you can learn the Swedish language. You also are given economic assistance so that you can join the school for some time and put your time, you know, focus on studies. And besides that, you are also today like given something like other opportunities, like you can you are registered in a job market, for instance. There are those who work with supporting the immigrants in job seeking processes, a job coach, for instance. All this kind of support those are provided. But besides all that, like I found something really interesting in Sweden, the fantastic part, we call it the community life in Sweden. Right, people meet, they share new ideas. I started as a volunteer, for instance, in Red Cross, where I met the people, those interesting people, those who are still a part of my circle of friends today, and began to engage in a political party where I'm still active. I believe Sweden, as a nation, like it provides the necessary infrastructure, framework, and the general public, through their involvement in various associations and community organizations, works in that spirit. So that's where I think the integration takes place. So that's where like I learn more about Sweden and Swedish mentality, Scandinavian concepts, and how it is supposed to be, and how it is expected to be a Swedish in Swedish context.
Akash, let us talk about the next generation a bit, because I mean, you're the first generation. You moved, you experienced what happened to you in Bhutan, India, Nepal, and then you found Sweden and you adopted Sweden, as Apita said, and in a way Sweden also adopted you. So you have the first experience. But we see in many countries that the following generations who have not gone through this, but they are maybe a different color of the skin, maybe some cultural differences, so they find it sometimes hard to accept and to, maybe that's the wrong word, accept. Maybe I should say, they find it hard to identify, because maybe when they go through school or kindergarten, they're already told by some other kids that they are different. They realize that themselves. So we see often that the next generations struggle a bit more with identity rather than those who have actually migrated themselves. So you are in Sweden, you raise your family and children in Sweden, and you obviously must also be in touch with other people who have migrated, who have children. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you see this? And I'm also curious whether you have some practical parenting tips here for the listeners who have children. What do you do to help your kids to, in a way, you know, not get lost in this kind of identity politics that might catch them for the wrong reasons?
Thank you so much. It's a really interesting question. You know, like identity issue is really a complex question or complex issue, especially for the second generations. For me, like if somebody called me an immigrant, I say that like, yeah, I am an immigrant. But what about my son who is born in Sweden? He plays hockey and he is very active member in the society. And he even been like, people around may call him an immigrant, whereas he deep down in the heart like feels and identifies himself as a Swedish with an immigrant background, of course. So like this question is really, really complex, especially for the second generation. As I said, raising my family in Sweden, I suddenly encountered moments where different cultures, values, classes, you know, like my heart from Nepal or Bhutan and India with Swedish nuns, and to navigate the expectations placed on my children in both this context. I think over time, my ADHD has, if I just look at me, evolved into a blend of both the cultures, where I cherish my roots. Yes, of course, I'm proud about it, while also embracing the values and opportunities that Sweden offers. So this is something like a pretty much mixture of these two. For my children, this means growing up with a strong sense of who they are, with an appreciation for both the culture and heritage and society they live in. I believe it's important for immigrant parents to create an environment where their children can explore and approach their cultural background without feeling pressure to choose one identity over the other. Encouraging for the open dialogue, fostering pride and heritage, and also allowing them to the space to navigate of their own in this identity journey. I think that is something. It's really important and very vital to manage to help them to understand who they are, so that they can have both of the part and also have a balanced understanding about their identity and also like try to understand who they are and what makes them special. That's something it's really important, I think, to give the space for this coming generations to, you know, like explore and learn and also have these two balanced paths in their life.
I think one important thing that you said there, Akash, like what really struck me is immigrant parents being open about children exploring and having an open debate, which I think sometimes these cultural expectations we pose on children over identity can sort of, you know, put them in this identity crisis of where do I belong? Because I'm growing up in a different society, but the cultural expectation you're placing on me is different. I've seen this as a, you know, larger issue, even with the Nepali immigrant communities abroad in various countries. So I really resonated with what you've said there. I think what we're also very interested in is exploring. So you briefly mentioned earlier that Sweden welcomed you. There were a lot of programs that, you know, sort of helped you in the integration process and make Sweden your own country. I was really wondering, you know, if there are some really specific programs that you feel are very key to the integration process, no matter which society, you know, immigrants are going to as host countries, you know, what kind of programs would be really helpful for immigrants? But do you think also like it should be a balance between government programs and community-led programs, or is there, you know, is it better if it comes from local communities? You know, what's been your experience in this overall immigration process?
Interesting question once again. I have both like experience of coming to this country and, you know, like get started from scratch and learn this stuff and figure it out and get integrated and feel at home in this country. And also like experience working with as a refugee coordinator, supporting people coming from different countries around. If you look at the Swedish context, like the government have like a kind of structured integration programs, which includes that they provide economic assistance to the people so that people have time to put in learning Swedish and norms and the values and civic knowledges and all that. And beside that, they also see that community organizations play a vital role. And if I look at my experience, the government's role in this context is like they have provided, and their role is to provide an infrastructure, because integration is not something that you put two people in a room and tell them, now you have to get integrated, talk to each other, get to learn each other and all that stuff. In that way, never any integration process takes place. It has to be in a natural dirt plan where, you know, like your ways of thinking meets with another ways of thinking, so that like in a natural way, you do the stuff and get to know to learn each other's ideas, ways of thinking, all that stuff. So my experience is like community organizations' role, even though I see it's very vital in helping integrating people, is not taken so much seriously in Swedish context too. There is much focus on, you know, like now we have the right wing, these political parties marching in Sweden. They are doing even other than the European countries, anti-immigrants rules and regulations. They are putting all kind of, they have come up with all kind of thoughts and changes. And there is much more focus on, you know, like there has to be some kind of restrictions. There has to be some kind of regulations. But what they miss out is it has never been the problem that we have some kind of we have rules and the regulations, and everyone is supposed to follow that. We don't need an additional just a specific rules just to, you know, like encounter or to take care of any specific immigrants groups. When we talk about like they have to be like we welcome them and let them be the part of the society, we have to open up and then take it out like what are then the challenges we have and what are then the possibilities we have, so that we can build something by understanding the ideas that is coming in then ideas that we have in this country. So like I think once again the government role here is to provide the infrastructure, and they have to open up and see the capabilities that we have at a community level where integration really can take place, where people get welcomed in a football club, like people migrated here from other countries, for instance, look at what is going on around in Syria, Gaza, and they come here with trauma. They come here not prepared to, you know, like take part in this organized Swedish studies. Like they have the family members still in a war zone, and they don't know whether they are going to make it out or not. So you know, like there are so many stuff going on. Just to help them, I think we have to create the government has to facilitate so that the general public they can get involved in taking care of, you know, like welcome this new commerce in the society, in their families, in the football club, in Red Cross organizations, in all other lobby organizations around, so that they can start from where it is possible, based on, you know, like what they have with them today and when they come to Sweden. So like this community part is something which is really vital. I think like that is the most important part, which unfortunately I personally feel that the government policies and the way they are forming new immigration policies and so on. I think they are missing it out, something we are working on at different levels to tell that like integration happens out there. So keep that in mind and work on, come on with new policies which stimulate so that more and more people can you know, like continue integration process out there.
Great. I think that's a fantastic conversation, Akash. Thank you so much. I think from you, we've actually got concrete policy solutions of not looking at this in absolutism of like, you know, whether this is good or bad, but to say there are a lot of nuances that are missing in this discussion. So thank you so much for giving us your time today. It has been wonderful catching up with you. And we really, really appreciate you sharing your story with us and fulfilling this immigration debate with a lot of missed nuances, I would say. Thank you, Akash.
Thank you so much for having me.
now that we've had this very, very fascinating discussion, it seems like migration should not really be looked as an isolated issue, but it is more a policy approach that encompasses other economic and social policies as well. So right now, you know, what do you think are the key highlights for you in the conversation so far?
Well, there were many. I thought it was so interesting to listen to three people from three different continents. Fascinating conversations. And maybe if I just start with what we heard from Ken and Farid, is that both those countries, the United States and Egypt, both have a long history of immigration. You might know this about one particular country, but not necessarily about Egypt, I believe. So it was good to hear that, you know, a long history, and both are convinced that it has benefited considerably to the development of the country over time.
That's true. I think for me, what I was taking away from this conversation is, because the issue on the outside, the debate about immigration just goes into very much ideological or irrational, I find sometimes, debate. I was trying to understand where the resistance is coming from. And I think we touched upon that issue a little bit. This kind of resistance, it looks like it's coming from when the population, overall population, faces economic hardships. And so we really then start discussing about who is different than us. And, you know, migration then becomes an issue. Because I think what Farid highlighted in terms of Egypt's example of being able to, integrate a lot of migrants in general, he thanked the informal economy because it's essentially a shadow economy, which means the regulation is much freer to enter into business. It's much freer to exit if your business fails. So that played an integral role. And I feel like he pointed out that this has provided employment opportunities. Also, like officially, Farid mentioned that, you know, Egypt has actually not had that bad of an unemployment statistic. So in general, they seem to be doing well, despite claims of, economic hardships. So I think when we are looking at the issue of immigration, it's much more important to look at what are the economic policies that are preventing us from unleashing the economic potential of all the people in the country, not just one category of people. And I think that is a very key takeaway for me.
And an important one, absolutely. It's, you know, the worries that the immigration raises in a country, and economic hardship obviously is one. And the other one, I believe, and I also picked that up from the speakers, is the fear of losing social norms and values. That's especially true if the immigration comes from countries with entirely different sets of norms. So this is something that one also needs to keep in mind. And it's, of course, a very difficult one to tackle. We brought this question to all our experts, and we heard that in response to children, for example, of immigrants struggling with the education system, basically because they do not know how to integrate, because they think this is not aligned with their traditional values that they bring from their original society where the family once migrated from. We heard from Ken that might then be a fault on the government education system. So if you try to enforce a standardized curriculum on everyone, and then we have suddenly people with very different backgrounds, it might just come to its limits. And maybe we need an education system that is broader and is able to accommodate all these different children. It's a tall order. It's not an easy one to solve. But in a way, we heard similar things from Akash when he said, children, that means the second generation after the initial immigration, or even the third generation, they were born in the country. They're kind of like citizens of the country, but they still are different. And they might be told that already when they're in kindergarten or in school that they're somewhat different. And so they have to find their identity. And it's a little harder for those kids rather than for those who went through the migration themselves. And so what he put so nicely, Akash, is when he said, in a way, they are merging two sets of values inside themselves. So the one from the host country and the one for where the family is from initially. And they need to do that. If an education system tries to enforce just one set of values, they will not be able to actually go along with that. It'll cause a conflict in them they can't resolve.
I completely agree. I think that was a key point that Akash made. One of the other things, like for me, that was very, very important to address in this, complex issue of immigration is where this public resentment is coming from. And the public resentment, like I said earlier, comes when government steps in and is using taxpayers' money. So I think in the discussion and debate, like Ken pointed this out quite well, is that help in general, there is help available out there. Like he made this point, like, you know, if you don't provide cheap labor coming into the country, the company is going to relocate to a place where there is cheap labor freely available, right? So in general, like help can be provided. It can be left to private support groups, philanthropists, or just the companies that are looking for this kind of labor in general. And I think that's a very, very key point. But also, I think in this whole process, what Akash brought it into the debate is this understanding when you're helping refugees, it's a special category of immigrants coming in. You know, they're coming from war-torn backgrounds. They carry this trauma. And that, in that sense, not just the infrastructure or the help that you provide from taxpayers' money is important, but also I think a key part of that actually is saying the emphasis is actually should be on communities, because that is where integration happens. It's not in these government programs that, you know, largely where the integration has happened, because these people need to live in communities. So I think he's also talked about, like, you know, working on changing Sweden's policies to be more community focused in that sense. So community, seeing community as an integral part of the integration process, I think is a key policy takeaway that we can take from this conversation.
Yes, and that takes me to the next takeaway that I actually have from this conversation. That is when the communities are then highly disturbed by reports about criminal acts, maybe terrorist acts even, committed by people with a migration background, which in many societies by now is 20-30% of the population. So one has to, of course, academically be sound and saying to what extent is it really the immigrants committing those crimes. But obviously we see that a lot of people in many countries are disturbed by criminals or terrorists among immigrants. And so the question is, how do we deal with this? And I think the resounding answer by the experts were that laws must be enforced and order must be maintained. So it cannot be that anybody gets away with anything just because they may have a social predicament being an immigrant. So if there are criminals, they should be dealt with individually and should be held accountable individually. Collective accountability, because they are coming from a certain group of people, is not an option under the rule of law. And we heard from Akash the same. He said, we have enough rules and regulations. So if the far right demands even more restrictions, we have enough. It just needs to be enforced so that, you know, everybody is dealt with the same under the rule of law.
Yeah. And I think that brings me towards like one of the key reflections in this whole debate is it is quite impossible to design a perfect system. You know, we will always have imperfections. The beauty of this debate or a liberal world order in general or having democratic practices in place is we get to go on a trial and error basis. No human being is perfect. No policy design is perfect and will eventually get a solution that is workable. And it will always be rough around the edges. There is no perfect solution in general. But I think what was a key takeaway for me in this imperfect, you know, policy solution is that A is having a faith that there is benefit in immigration. It is a part of human history. It's how civilizations move forward. We learned from each other. So, you know, based on that history that we carry with ourselves as human beings, let alone from whatever nation you come from, I think it's very important to see that there is, like, to put it at the heart is there are benefits to immigration and we really need to approach this issue. And it outweighs a lot of the costs. But that as liberals, we just have to tolerate imperfect solutions. And that's just a part of life. So, yeah, I think that was a very, very interesting conversation overall. Thank you for joining with us today. This podcast has been brought to you by IAF, and we would love it if you would join in the discussion. Please feel free to reach out to us via any social media platforms of the Academy. We'd love to hear and learn from your thoughts as well. Bye for now.
Goodbye.